Hello and welcome to episode 5 of series 2 of our podcast, Simply Holistic Living. In this episode, I have a great chat with Niall Breslin, who is a really inspiring mental health advocate. I first met Niall on a project that we're working on to do with the restoration of a graveyard in St. Lomond Psychiatric Hospital. And I've been just so impressed by the work he's doing in the area of mental health to change the conversation on mental health, the advocacy he does around the young people and mental health. I just asked Niall to come on the podcast and have a chat, so it was great. Niall holds a degree in economics and sociology, a master's degree in mindfulness-based intervention, and he's currently doing a PhD, along with all the mighty work he's doing around mental health. So enjoy. Hi, Niall, and thanks for joining me on the podcast today. I've been working with you on this small project to do with the memorial wall in St. Lomond's in Mullingar. And I've been really impressed by the work you've done, and I've been reading your book, Me and My Mate Jeffrey, and that's just taken me away completely, you know, from where you've come from, your dealings with Jeffrey, and all the work that you do now in the mental health advocacy and your PhD. For the podcast, really, what I'm thinking of is the listeners that are out there that are stuck, are struggling, are in that dark place. Where you came from, how do you make that jump? What's that journey been about?
To me, currently at this moment in time, if there's anybody in the world that's perfectly calm and stress-free, I'd like to meet them, because the world has been incredibly overwhelming over the last number of years, and we've had a front row seat to it. We've seen every aspect of it. We've had barbaric, heartbreaking wars. We've had cost of living crisis, global pandemics, austerity, recessions. I could name another 10 things. So a lot of people are feeling immensely overwhelmed by that. It's a huge weight to carry. And then if you throw other things into the equation, like relationship issues or grief or, I don't know, financial problems, it can just feel like it's just so intense. It's so hard. It's hitting you right in the face. And I think first and foremost, we should acknowledge that people... I struggle with the word resilience. It gets thrown around way too much. And anyone who's listening to this that's still upright after what we've gone through, you're the very definition of what resilience actually is. You don't need to be more resilient. In my own case, it was a different time, I suppose. It was when I was in my most overwhelmed state was as a teenager in the 90s when I was dealing with chronic panic disorder. And living in a society and culture that called people like Kurt Cobain a coward when he died, that's what I was exposed to. So I was absolutely under no circumstances going to start talking about what I think I was going through at the time, which of course makes a hell of a lot more destructive when you repress it and internalize it and pretend it doesn't exist. You try to outdrug it, you try to outdrink it, you try to outrun it, but you can't. And ultimately it catches up with you, which it did for me. And then you've a choice then to decide how to react to it. And the only choice I had left was to put my hand up and look for help, proper help. And it came. And when it came, like it doesn't fit into the narrative we like to have for mental health, where you're like, everything just changed. It didn't. It took a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of patience and a lot of breakdowns and breakups and all of that stuff. But ultimately, what it led me to understand is that life is not a straight line, and there will be times in my future where I'll be hit again. And it's how I react to that that changes everything for me. But yeah, it's led me on a deep understanding of my own personal experience, which I think has helped me understand other people, and essentially led me back to academia to understand, why aren't we doing things to help people? Why aren't we actually changing how society functions, so people don't feel like it's constantly slapping them in the face? And that's what I do. It's, you know, I'd like to come on here and tell you I've got it all figured out, but I absolutely don't.
I think that's kind of what reading your book and getting to know you, sometimes you hear these jargon thrown around about mental health and mental health journeys. And I've had lots of close friends in my life who've had huge struggles. And, you know, knowing that it's not a straight line. That's what you're talking about there, that it's not a straight line. That really comes across in your book. And it's your reaction the whole time, you know. That's what I'm passionate about, is how far have we come in Ireland to have that mental health, that conversation about our emotions, about our emotional well-being, you know, at an institutional level, at a society level, all of those things.
Yeah, I think when I think about it and I look historically at the last 200 years, which seems like a mad amount of time to be looking at it, but that is, context is everything when you do this work. And the thing you start to realize is we've never been comfortable with anything that wasn't normal. So what we had is we had people who got to dictate what was normal and what was abnormal. And we still have those. That still exists. Like, what is normal? I haven't a clue what normal is. And it's a silly word, even when it comes to mental health. And what I think has happened is I think Ireland has definitely reduced the stigma around things like stress and anxiety and, you know, breakdown and stuff like that. But it's still not comfortable with the deeper, more difficult conversations, like the more serious mental health issues that we would see. Resulting from probably years of neglect and not dealing with things. I think we still struggle with that. When Sinead O'Connor died, you know, you got to see that full social discourse and how far that we were. I saw a guy under a post that I put up about her saying she was an incredible singer, but a total nut job. That was his wording. He couldn't see the point that was anyway offensive. He actually thinks he was being kind of almost optimistic about her. It was a strange thing to see. Which made me realize I don't think we're as far as we think we are in mental health. And I also think our systems that support people who are vulnerable, who might find themselves in those dark places, our systems are absolutely not where they need to be. They're a long way off. They are in many ways still adopting the same stuff that we used to do to people in the 50s, 60s and 70s. We used to just numb them, and we used to just drug them, and we used to do things like lobotomy and insulin coma therapy and ECT and malaria treatment. This is what we did in our absolute therapeutic, as it was referred to as a psychiatrist friend of mine, therapeutic enthusiasm. To me, it sounded like therapeutic desperation or therapeutic barbarism, if I'm honest. And I think there are legacies that still prevail from that system, even though people will argue otherwise. But that's the whole focus of my PhD. The reason I'm doing the PhD is because I believe the patterns that we established during that 200-year period are still there. They're still not being acknowledged. And until we actually acknowledge them and look at a way of moving away from them, me and you are going to have this conversation in 10 years' time. So that's kind of the work I'm trying to do.
Not a conversation I want to be having in 10 years' time.
No.
It's that kind of, I know the people that have come through the mental health system currently that are drugged and are on antidepressants, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with antidepressants, but are on serious drugs for 20, 30 years and no other resources being thrown at them.
You see, the international literature, in scientific literature, has consistently pointed us away from a sole focus on the medical model, which is essentially what we have. We will see things in reports and like the Vision for Change and Sharing the Vision, you know, psychosocial interventions, but they're just words, because what you then have is consultant-led multidisciplinary teams. Like if you look at the CAMHS report of 2023, there was psychiatrists in Dubai diagnosing children in Kerry over Zoom and putting them on medication, not monitoring them. Now this isn't aspirin we're putting the children on. So this is just a reality of it. So I think we have to move away. I don't think this. International literature is telling us this. We need to move away from this strict focus on a medical model. It has a part to play. It will always have a part to play. But what happens is when we solely focus on that, we don't develop other models like early prevention, trauma-informed care. We don't develop proper psychological support systems because they're expensive. And there's no doubt about that. You know, it is much easier just to kind of to solve a problem very quickly in a GP's office. But it takes much more work to take somebody to figure out why it is they're feeling the way they feel, to uncover that, to work through it, and then to give somebody kind of some way forward. That could take years, or it could take months. It could take, but it's an investment in that individual that, you know, I don't think we're anywhere close to yet. And I think that's reality. I think mental health and the World Health Organization tells us this. It's, you know, the first almost chapter of how to write good mental health policy. It says you've got to look at the social environment. What is the person surrounded by? What are they dealing with? What happened to that person? Whereas I think our model to this point has been, what's wrong with you? Not what happened to you. And until we start asking people what happened to you, we're going to be once again stuck in this situation. And I don't want to appear in any way negative. I actually believe Ireland can be world leaders at youth mental health. I think we can. We're a population of 5 million. I think the issues are complex. The solutions are not. And government will tell us they're complex. They're not. They're actually pretty straightforward. We're just not doing them.
And how do we change that? How do we get in there? Is the media got a role to play to get people fired up in this country about mental health? Does it have to, you know, does it need to come from the people?
I think it has to be politically expedient. So politicians need to believe that it will garner votes if they invest in it. But the thing about it is, this is where it gets complex, and this is where we have to think differently. Like, if we just get more money and more funding and put it into the same system, we're wasting money. Like, yes, we need more resources in mental health. Yes, we need more funding. But if we're just putting it into the same model that we have now and the same, you know, some of the budget going in just to keep old asylums heated, like, it's a ridiculous system. So change happens by people, but more importantly, the biggest thing we got to look for when it comes to change is looking at the power dynamics that exist in the society, the vested interests, the interests that would like us just to keep doing the same thing constantly. That's what you got to look at if you want to tackle the issue. You also need politicians who have courage and bravery to look at a new paradigm here. The Mental Health Commission, after the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, said it doesn't need more money. It needs a root and branch change. That's a huge statement. That's like, you need to stop doing what you're doing, and we need a completely different model of care. And that's the Mental Health Commission. Their entire remit is designed around that. So the question you need to ask if you care about mental health is, why aren't we? Why aren't we looking at better ways of care? I read an article today in the paper about psychologists in schools. I remember Norma Foley put out that post. She goes, like, we're going to put psychologists in schools. And that day I said it to everybody, where is she going to get them? And what was the post out today? It was like, there's not enough psychologists. So politicians will kite fly. They will throw out, in this year of election, they're going to throw out some lovely things and they're going to say great things. But change does not come with words or policy. Change comes below that. It becomes with changing power dynamics in society and getting people to understand that ultimately in a democracy, they hold the key and the power. And if you care about this and you genuinely care about this, then you should make politicians aware that you do. So they're aware this is politically expedient, but it is scary and it's complex. The other thing we do, Julie, is, and I know I'm talking a lot now, but we silo things. We put mental health over there and health. Then we put education over there, and then we put social welfare over there. And then we put all these departments, and there's no one talking to each other. Mental health will not be solved by health alone. Health is not, there's much more to it than health. There's policy, there is good social policy, there's inequality, there's inequity, all these things that have to be looked at. And that's why it feels like too big a problem for a lot of politicians. And I understand that.
Yeah, it's been my passion from the time I was a young woman. I've gone to mental health conferences, some of it to do with my work, and been hearing the same things for so many years. So it's a question that's just there constantly with me about how, what we've talked about, the how do we change it? Do we get people, like what you're saying, to contact the politicians to say, this has got to change? how do we get that culture shift? And sometimes I think I'm really impatient. I want it now.
I think we are. We all are. But one thing I think is important to point out, people think change is more money. Put more money into it. I don't think that's the answer. I genuinely don't. I think we are putting more money. Yes, we need resources. Yes, we need it. Of course we need. It's currently at about 6% of the health budget. What I think it needs is much bigger than that. It needs us to look at this in an entirely different lens. I would argue that they need to put some form of early prevention task force that has no connection to anyone else that's doing this work. Like I could, you know, you look at people like Dr. Tony Bates, these incredible minds. And we start a lot of I was on a youth mental health task force for the government a couple of years ago, and it was a talking shop. There was nothing done, nothing. Because there was no teeth, and it was the same people who were put on the task force who were already within the system. So I know this sounds radical, but that is actually what this needs. It needs a radical shift in how we think. And we got to look that we won't save the world overnight. So let's start somewhere. Let's maybe focus and phase it. Look at phase one. How do we develop very strong and well-implemented early prevention programs and early intervention programs? How do we educate children on how to deal with the ins and outs and ups and downs of life, but also if a child is overwhelmed by the world or is perhaps autism or some other area that makes the world overwhelming for them, we intervene, we assess, and we create. And we keep doing that, and we look at that generation, and we put our arms around them, and we develop really effective systems for them. And that generation can then carry that forward. And that's how we look at early prevention. And of course, there are bigger problems within our crisis model. Like we need 24-hour mental health services. We need to look at the law. Like there's a huge push around legal reform of our Mental Health Act, which was 2001. And the Mental Health Act, don't get me wrong, was a lot further on from the previous legal situation. The first legal act for mental health in Ireland was called the Dangerous Lunatics Act. Straight away, there is your connection between criminality and mental health. There is your stigma. And then when you look at our mental health acts in Ireland currently, we were ratified the United Nations Charter on Human Rights. And there are still elements of our current Mental Health Act that completely go against that. So there's really basic stuff here. And it's not happening because of bureaucracy, red tape, fear, and vested interests and power dynamics. And people look to me and go, like, how do you know this? It's because this is what I'm researching. This is what I look at every single day. I look at this every day, and I look at this with motivation and optimism that this can change, because Ireland's good at change. And above everything, I believe Irish people believe in fairness. And this isn't fair, and we shouldn't tolerate it. And I think that's the way people have to think, because they think in their head, well, there's no alternative. There is. There is always an alternative. And I think that's where we're stuck now. People go, well, Sinn Féin will come in and they'll fix it. I haven't heard Sinn Féin make one coherent statement on mental health. I haven't heard any of them, because they keep talking about the same thing. Let's just put more money into the system.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to have you on the podcast on this, is that conversation is so important. Those small conversations we're having today, will go out more and more and more of those conversations to ignite people to lead, and I think what you're saying is we need to be positive about it, that we can change. And we have shown that we can do it.
And we can. And it won't be easy, and it'll be messy and it'll be complicated, but it can be done. And I think anyone listening to this, do not see this as negative. This is awareness. Become aware of the system. Understand it. And there are many brilliant writers out there that can help you. Damien Brennan's Irish Insanity is a brilliant book to read. Brendan Kelly's work is amazing. You know, his book, Hearing Voices, is an unbelievable book on the Irish mental health system. And these are top-class academics. These aren't people just shouting at you with opinion. These are people who've done huge research on this. So I think we should listen to them.
Yeah, there's people out there. What I'm thinking when I'm listening to you is, you know, all the things for the starting place, the early intervention, the law. And I suppose I'm also thinking of my past work in community work and the adults that I came across who are in the system, who are drugged up with no other resources and are left there isolated. this is where I would love to see some program, particularly men, not only men, but particularly men that I would have met that. And that's, I suppose, what struck me so much about reading your book and the work that you do, you know, as a male mental health advocate.
There's huge problems that you're right. When you talk about community care, I read a brilliant line in one of the books I was reading. It said, we can't have community care unless we have a community that cares. And we have to care for the most vulnerable. We have to. And I did my initial degree was in economics. And I can tell you, it's a very blunt instrument on which to judge a society. And we got to find other ways of putting our arms around the vulnerable in society and not making them feel abnormal. That's the other thing, is this idea that we used to always perceive that it was othering is what we call this, othering. That's them, it's not us. It is, that they are us. That's the point. And I think in mental health care and community care, what we need, when you look at how mental health systems first started in Ireland in 1817 and across the world, they started with something called moral intervention. And moral intervention, or moral management, they took the person, whoever it was, and they brought them into the institution and gave them refuge. They fed them. They talked to them. They gave them solace. They gave them a warm bed. They walked around the hospital with them and you know, sat in rooms with them and talked through what happened to them. And it was actually developed by the Quakers. The Quakers were the guys who were like, listen, if somebody's struggling with their, you know, maybe they're, it's because something happened to them. So this was moral management. Brilliant. And then there was a lobby for control of the asylums by what they refer to as the medical men. And once they took over, and it wasn't their fault, to be honest, because these institutions became so overrun because politicians used them as dumping grounds for prisons, for anyone who was different. And the medical men just couldn't deal with it. There was too many. And ultimately, moral intervention went down the toilet. So the reason I'm saying that is, I think we need to return to that model of care. Whether we take people and we bring them into kind of like farms, there's this amazing, they've done it in Norway and in Italy, with these farms for people, and they bring them and they work the land and they stay outdoors, and it's a beautiful, they're well taken care of, they're well fed, they have good psychologists and psychotherapists, they have group work. And this type of effective care is really effective in the community. And so, as I said, it's not like we don't know that this can work. And that was not the medical men's fault. That was politics, who just started using the asylums as bins for people who were different. And, you know, I know you care greatly for this area, but that's what happens. And so to me, the paradigm shift, you talk about those men in the community who are vulnerable, a lot of them didn't end up vulnerable overnight, you know, and if they find themselves in a vulnerable position because of something that happened to them, a trauma, an addiction, they when we let them go like that, we lose them. And we lose them to society, we lose them to our economy, we lose them to our humanity. We lose them. And we shouldn't be losing these people. And I think that's kind of how I look at it. They're valuable.
Yeah, they're valuable. They're part of our community. It's, you know, I mean, I love what you say, that we need a community who cares. And I think that's a kind of crucial thing. So it's like there's so much in this. Sometimes I've felt overwhelmed by the whole change that is needed. But when you break it down to some of the things that you've spoken about, the, you know, where we can start, the early intervention, a caring community. If there's people, you know, listening to this who are struggling themselves or are aware or have a family member, is there anything to kind of bring it back to the individual that you would say to somebody who's listening and saying, okay, I can contact my politicians around getting those changes. I can be an advocate myself, write to the politicians, but what can I do myself if I'm struggling? Now, and I know there's no one answer and you don't have answers and I don't have answers, but are there tools, are the resources that people could pull on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and this is utterly subjective. Like, we don't know what's the reason this anybody is struggling. But one of the things I say to people is, we can create emotional scaffolding for people around us. We can just say, listen, if you feel like you're falling, hold on to me. or if you need me to pick you up, let me pick you up. And the way to do that is through non-judgment. Like you can't be judging people. We don't know what anyone's carrying. So I think you need to create an environment where people feel okay with expressing what's going on inside them. And whether that's in your community, in your family, in your workplace, it doesn't matter. We all have the power to create that emotional scaffolding. And you don't need to be doctors. You don't need to fix people or save them. You just need to make them feel that if there's something going on for them, they can talk about it. And if there is something going on for you, the one thing I've learned is, you know, within like a therapeutic, there's many options and avenues to therapy. You can go to mymind.ie. It's an amazing website. And basically, they'll facilitate your therapy. If you can't afford it, they're a charity. If you go, right, I've only got €20 this week, you pay €20. And it's a brilliant way of getting into therapy and getting it started. These are world-class therapists. They're not like, you know, they're supported and compensated by a charity, so they're able to offer their time. And I think get in and allow someone else help you make sense of what's going on for you. And maybe the way you're feeling is a perfectly rational way. It might be really uncomfortable and really intense, but there are people that know what to do with all of that. And I think that's why I'm very passionate about making, and not everybody needs therapy. Sometimes people just need an arm around them. That's all they need. They need their peers to tell them that they're with them. But above everything, it's okay to fall apart. Like, it is okay to fall. I've fallen apart more times than I care to imagine. And in fact, I've had to, because I couldn't carry it anymore. It was too heavy. And if I tried to carry it, it would have been worse than that. So falling apart is okay. And a brilliant Dr. Richard Hogan, I had him on the podcast, he said something to me. He goes, you know what, Niall? Most of us are just okay most of the time. And that's grand. We don't need to save the world. We don't need to be having like Hollywood moments every single day. We don't need that. And most of us don't have that. And it's okay. And I think that's something that I learned. But more than anything, I'm not afraid to fall apart if I need to.
Niall, I think that's a nice way, a good way to finish the chat. It's, you know, it's okay to fall apart. And I think that's something that really strikes a chord with me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it will strike a chord with people that are listening. And so much, many times in society, we try to, everything has to be perfect. Thanks very much, Niall.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really enjoyed my chat with Niall, exploring mental health and what needs to change on a local and national level. I'm wishing Niall all the best in the work that he does, and of course, in his PhD.